listening to the 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon presented by CFMH in St. John, New Brunswick. For CJLO 6090 AM in Montreal, Quebec, I'm Allison O'Reilly.
And I'm Jessica Jashek. Montreal is Canada's second most populated province, and with a high population comes a lot of public responsibility. We found that a census released in 2015 indicated that there are more than 3,000 homeless people living on the island of Montreal. So for every 10,000 citizens, there are 15 people facing homelessness.
And with Montreal only having approximately 37 shelters with just over 1,400 beds, there is definitely a growing need for nonprofits to pick up where government services sometimes fail. And one of the nonprofits that is helping to pick up the slack is a community organization called Cactus. Now, Cactus's main goal is to prevent blood-transmitted diseases and sexually transmitted infections, especially of at-risk individuals and homeless people. They offer a variety of services, including messengers en route, a needle exchange program, and a safe injection site.
Two of the main projects that we profiled for this year's edition of the Homelessness Marathon were Projet pour toi and Aztec, which stands for Quebec Trans Health Action. So Projet pour toi is for people living in a chronic situation of homelessness who use services of Cactus Montréal and those of its partners. The project really aims to improve the quality of life for its participants by focusing on the development of independence, social skills, and helping them navigate through the government services that are offered.
Now, Projet pour toi is still considered a quote-unquote baby project. You know, it's only been around for 3 years, and it followed in the footsteps of Plaisirs, which is another Cactus program that is aimed for sex workers. But Projet pour toi is an independent housing first program. You know, they have about 30 places. Projet pour toi pays part of the rent for the individuals who use the service. They buy furniture and groceries at the beginning, and then throughout the program, they provide support and stability. The program is a 4-year program, and it ends in March of 2019. Now, we spoke with the coordinator of Projet pour toi, Karine Bricot. She has been working with Cactus for 7 years now, and she has coordinated Projet pour toi since the very beginning. So we spoke to her about how Projet pour toi works and who has access to these services.
So we meet up with the participants once a week. Well, ideally, it's not always that easy to get to see them once a week. Just a reminder, I mean, these are people who have been on the streets for many, many years. Just the fact that they have an appointment with us, it's something that's kind of new, just an appointment every week. So just the fact that we get to see them like maybe once, twice, three times during the month, it's pretty good. We're moving forward when that happens. So we can help them with whatever they need, actually, if they need to get a doctor, if they have legal issues, if they have if they want to find work, they want to go back to school, we're there to accompany them in that and try and see further than just tomorrow. That's basically, that's a big part of the project. I'm gonna try and look a bit more ahead. And obviously the Housing First projects will rely on the fact that if you have a home, an apartment, it's gonna be easier to do all the rest. Obviously it's not enough to just have an apartment. It doesn't solve all your problems. So we're there to try and, motivate them to go a bit further.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we are also there to, if needed, be a mediation with the landlords, because that's always a big issue. I mean, even for us, having the landlord can be an issue. So for people who have most of them have maybe, never had any contact with the landlord or have never paid any rent because, they wandered about. We kind of learn together, there are certain things you have to do, certain things you can't do, certain things, how can I say that? So, relations still stay good. So we help on that front as well.
As Karen mentioned, having a home doesn't necessarily eliminate the surrounding factors that could have led someone to ending up on the streets. We asked Karen what some of the issues that Projet pour toi has been facing.
I'd say the most recurrent issue is being able to see them. For us, that's one of the major issues. They don't have phones. They don't have any way we can really well, some of them do, but some of them don't. And even when they do, that doesn't mean we're able to speak to them often. That's one of the really recurring issues. There's also a difficulty to get them into, especially when it concerns their health, to see a doctor, to see a psychiatrist, to see, even when they want to go see a psychiatrist, which is pretty rare, we're not able to. It's just so difficult. And I mean, if it's difficult for us, imagine somebody who's never really been in that, you know. So, because now that they're in an apartment, they're no longer homeless, so they don't have access to some of the homeless programs that the CLSC can offer. So there are 8 Housing First projects in Montreal, so we work together to work on these issues. And the CLSC's ended up letting them continue have access to the homeless, the programs that were for homeless people, because, I mean, they're in an apartment, but they don't feel as if they're not homeless yet. So that's really something we have to take in consideration. And, those are the 2 major issues that we've been confronted with for now. Some discrimination from the part of landlords when we call. Usually we do the calls. All the research for an apartment is always done with the person. We never do it without them because it's going to be their home. But often they prefer that we call, and it's also sometimes easier because we can explain the project. But we still get landlords who don't want people on welfare, or if they don't want to say it that way, there are credit checks, and they know it's not going to work out. So it's hard to prove discrimination, but when you have them on the phone and it's afterwards, it's the way they say things, the way they talk about their the people who are in their apartments. I mean, we haven't really, not saying we're not doing anything, we're collecting all this information. Obviously, it's not us that are discriminated, it's the person. So the person has to want to do something, and it's a long process. So what we do is we collect all that, maybe to speak up about something bigger.
Not everyone has access to Projet Portois. We asked Karen who's allowed to use these services.
The only condition is that the person be a drug user, because since we have activities here in Cactus, we don't want to bring people who don't use drugs to Cactus, because that can always be an issue. So that was the only condition with our partners that we put forward. But we do have a couple spots that are people who don't really come to Cactus.
Homeless individuals face a lot of discrimination within the community. So we wanted to know how the community has responded to Projet Portois.
The community response is pretty good. I mean, and here I talked about landlords with which it's not going well, but there are some who are really who really believe in these projects. What's been a bit difficult is, as I was saying, there are 8 different projects, and we all kind of have the same name, and we're all looking in the same city. So, landlords and the community sometimes get confused by who's who, which is normal. But it's been a pretty good response. Obviously, I think a lot of people believe that, having an apartment is the first step to doing really other stuff and just stabilizing what's going on in your life. What they don't really see is everything that comes with it, and all the work that has to be around it. You can't just have an apartment. You really need people are going to be there to help you, to accompany you on your way. Some participants, I mean, just needed like that little nudge, and they do stuff by themselves, and that's great. Others need a bit more of our presence.
Projet Portois does so much. We were wondering how the community could help lend a hand.
I'd say, like, on a bigger level, it's just talking about these projects and talking about Well, about the people who participate in these projects, because, I mean, they could be your neighbor and you may not know that that person is in our program. So there's something, there's always something to do about stereotypes and discrimination. On a more specific level, obviously the community can always do, I mean, we're always... I'm not going to say we need clothes or we need furniture because we're never going to be able to take all that, but it's obviously something that's always good to have people who call and say, well, you know, I have this. Do you guys need it? Because we have funding, but, you know, it's always good to have more if you can. So I'd say that's pretty much it, but I think the most just... talking about it and, you know, just not letting yourself get caught up in discrimination. I think that's the best thing that could happen.
Another organization that we decided to profile within Cactus was AZTEC, which stands for Quebec Trans Health Action. It was created in 1998 in the need for trans individuals to have access to social services as well as healthcare. The project really grew out of support for trans women who were living with HIV and they needed to access the health system.
So we had a chance to speak with James Mackay. Now, James Mackay has been working with AZTEC for 3 years, and his current position is as an intervenant. He is currently working in social intervention, access, transfer information, as well as creating trainings. So to start things off, we asked James about the relationship between homelessness and the LGBTQ community.
Definitely, LGBT-identified people are overrepresented in the homeless population. And unfortunately, because of homophobia and transphobia and sexism, it's really, really hard to access shelters for many, many different reasons. On top of those reasons, when we get into looking at intersectionality, it becomes a whole other ballgame. So we're not just talking about trans people, we're talking about trans people with many different identities as well. And so I think part of the thing that we're working on right now, with the help of, of the director of Cactus and also Serge Larroux, who's newly appointed for the RAPSIM, is also on it. So we're in touch with him, and he's very interested in supporting AZTEC and supporting trans people and figuring out how to get access. So that partnership with the government or an arm of the government is very important. But definitely, I mean, homelessness can happen for many different reasons, especially in the trans community. We see a lot of youth, unfortunately, who come out to their parents and are kicked out of their homes. And I feel like this was a narrative that was really put forward, 10 years ago, and people are sometimes surprised to hear that trans kids still get kicked out of their homes, but it definitely still happens. So you end up with youth who have no idea how to navigate systems, have no idea how to navigate services, who end up pretty lost and with very few places to go. If you're under 18, under 25, there's one or two at least shelters that one could access, and they're mixed shelters. But as soon as you age out of those services, it becomes a lot more difficult. We also see a lot of middle-aged people who, you know, have led the quote-unquote traditional lifestyle of, you know, going to school, getting married, having kids, the white picket fence, job with, you know, like, pension, blah, 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 and then decide to transition and quite literally lose it all, lose their family, lose their job, lose their home. And so you also have, you know, people who are, you know, middle class, have never needed to access a service, have never needed to do these things, are suddenly on the street and needing, you know, quite a bit of help orienting their new life. I don't know how to call it, but so there's kind of, those are different examples, but, you know, there's everything in between, I'll say. You know, there's like lots of people who grow up and know their identity very young and are queer and are just like, you know what, I can't handle this home anymore, it's transphobic, I'm leaving, and, you know, link up with a trans community immediately and figure it out for themselves. So I think when we're talking about a trans community, it's so large and the experiences are so diverse that it's hard to kind of boil it down to a common experience. But definitely, if I were to boil it down, I would say, you know, having trouble accessing shelters definitely has been a common thread for a lot of trans people. And I mean, it's also, I think I have sympathy also for the shelter system. We work with lots of shelters regularly, and they all are also super underfunded, super understaffed. There aren't enough shelters, there aren't enough beds ever. So I think we're all just struggling with a system that is just not meeting the needs of anyone right now, to be quite honest.
Knowing the relationship between the LGBTQ community and homelessness, we asked James to elaborate on the services and outreach that Aztec provides.
Well, one of the things that we do is we've reached out over many, many years, actually. This has been a project for many years on accompanying shelters in their desire to be a little bit more not only trans-inclusive, but also teach people how to address transphobia that happens within the shelter, because often what we hear is that the shelters are worried about their current participants and how they will react, and sometimes, obviously legit, it's a legit worry, but sometimes it's also, I feel like, a bit of a projection because they might have already had trans people accessing their services and they just didn't know, so really there was nothing that changed. But anyways, we work a lot with shelters. We consult with them. We are available if they have questions. We've worked very hard on trying to get trainings done. We have a Trans 101 that is really just a 101 for now, but we're looking at kind of expanding the scope of the trainings that we offer for sure. But in the training, it does talk about different trans realities. It talks about how to, essentially how to be less or not transphobic when speaking to a trans person or addressing a trans person or supporting a trans person. And throughout kind of the trainings, we are able to kind of zero in on the actual interventions that they're doing and the worries that we have. So we have the freedom to kind of cater a little bit the trainings to the actual on-the-ground needs of the intervenants or the shelters. We also do a lot of accompaniments. So we're trying to get at things from all angles, essentially. Trying to work, you know, with the administration, with the directors of certain shelters so that, you know, policy and things like that can be clear, that like they can say with no hesitation that trans women, for example, are accepted at a women's shelter. And then to have that kind of play out on the ground and also support the intervenants who are actually accompanying or welcoming trans women into their shelter. Sometimes we accompany the trans person there as well, just to like make sure that they get in and it's all fine, that they feel supported. So we're kind of trying all different angles, and it's definitely a slow process, but definitely in the last 3 years, I would say that I've been here, I've seen great changes in terms of access for trans women in some women's shelters.
When talking about homelessness, you'd be remiss to not discuss employment. So we asked James how Aztec provides support and helps trans individuals find work.
Employment is really tricky, mostly, well, for lots of different reasons, but also because transphobia is really hard to prove. So if you are refused from a job based on transphobia, it's really, really difficult to prove that. And also, do you really want to work somewhere, like fight to work somewhere that is going to be transphobic at the get-go? I don't know. People are definitely desperate for jobs, and not just trans people, but lots of different people accept to work in horrible conditions because they need that paycheck. So I think it definitely the barriers to employment mostly regard transphobia specifically. I think, like, if you think about intersectionality again, you know, there's lots of different reasons why people get refused for jobs. And it's a lot harder to change that, to react as an organization. We definitely help people write CVs. We definitely do practice interviews if people want to practice answering questions. We have a clothing exchange, which can offer kind of, you know, business casual, whatever, something that might be appropriate for an interview at a place. But most of the things that we're able to do are before the job interview. We don't really have a lot of ability to react post interview if they get a job, if they even get an interview. But what we are able to kind of help people understand is the new kind of laws that have happened that trans people have finally gotten recognition in terms of human rights at the provincial level and at the federal level. But at the same time, like, going through a human rights complaint because you were refused a job for many people is not worth their time, unfortunately. Time or mental health that goes into that. So it's, employment is definitely a lot trickier. I mean, one thing that I can say is that Aztec is 100% buy and force, so we only hire trans people as a choice.
We can't always control or stop discrimination, but we can control who we support and offer our time to. We asked James how the community can help Aztec further their mission.
The next time you hear a transphobic joke saying that's not funny, you know, it happens all the time. It happens on television shows constantly.
Yep.
So there can be tiny interventions like that, which are just daily. There can be other ways for sure. We always accept donations. Unfortunately, money is one of our biggest problems. But we do have what's called an emergency fund, which is a fund that is available to trans people in financial precarity. And so the money that we receive by donations goes directly into the hands of trans people in need, which is something that we feel very lucky to offer. And I mean, we're always looking for more doctors who are interested in operating in the informed consent model to prescribe hormones, to support trans people. Obviously, not every trans person is interested in a medical transition or any kind of medical intervention, but it is really hard to access those if one does want that. So I personally have been encouraging lots of my cis friends to talk to their doctors. If you go into your doctor, ask them if they would prescribe hormones. Offer them some, you know, there's the WPATH, there's lots of resources that we could provide them with if they're interested in supporting a trans person. That would be amazing. And I wonder what other ways. There's actually every way. There's an organization called Taking What We Need, which is specifically around to support trans feminine people. And it's also around kind of putting money into the hands of trans people. You know, we're talking about employment, and, you know, there's a study done in 2010 called Trans Pulse, which is one of the only research projects that was done by and for trans people, actually, that came out with the statistics of that. I think there were 460-something, maybe 80-something respondents, and the majority of whom had access to post-secondary education, so had been able to access kind of that beginning part of a narrative where you go to school, you know, you get your degree, you get all the knowledge, but then the getting the job part is the thing that doesn't happen. So we have a ton of, you know, super educated trans people that are not able to get jobs strictly around transphobia. And I think it said more than 50% of people who had post-secondary education were living on $15,000 or less a month.
Oh, my God.
So it's pretty discouraging when you look at the statistics. But in terms of employment, yeah, it's really, really difficult.
So as we can see, discrimination and stigma are holding these individuals, especially trans individuals, back from progressing in life, and they're making them more at risk of homelessness.
And discrimination plays a large factor in this, as we heard from James and Karen. We can't judge. We have to just really be open-minded and realize that a lot of these individuals come from different backgrounds. A lot of it has to do, too, with our government, the services that offer. The last few years, a lot of funding has been cut. So when it comes to community involvement and helping, you don't technically need to donate money. You could donate your time. If you have an old couch or clothes, and just really stopping the discrimination and placing our biases on the ideas and what we consider to be homelessness and the issues around it.
Exactly. And the way, you don't have to necessarily help directly in the case of giving money or giving clothes. You can also help indirectly by trying to reduce the stigma in your own personal community. When someone tells a joke that is offensive, telling them that that is not okay.
I think something that really resonated with me was when Karen said it could be your neighbor. It doesn't necessarily, just because someone is in a home doesn't mean they're not considering themselves to still be homeless. So yeah, just reaching out, acknowledging that we have an idea that someone is on the street panhandling and that's what homelessness is. But that isn't always the case. Even once they have a home, we need community support, social support, to really make sure that there's these building blocks to support one another.
Absolutely. And this brings on to the issue of like silent homelessness. You know, the homeless people aren't just those who are panhandling on the street, as you said. These are people in shelters. There are families that are homeless together. You know, they're in transitional housing. There's so many facets to this.
Marathons like the Homelessness Marathon are there to remind people that even though we're in 2018, this isn't going away. And we're always going to be in situations that might put us in tough predicaments, but it doesn't define who we are. And as a community, we could come together, have these discussions, these dialogues, and help people when they need it the most. For more information about Cactus and Projet Pour Toi, visit www.cactusmontreal.org.
And to learn more about the services offered at Aztec, visit www.aztec.org. That's spelled ASTTEQ.org. For CGLO 6090 AM in Montreal, Quebec, I'm Allison O'Reilly.
And I'm Jessica Jashek. This has been the 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon presented by CFMHFM in St. John, New Brunswick.